From beach towels to tea towels and from mugs to water bottles, the TNT Shop has it all. Browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Damian Richardson on today's News Talk. TNT Radio.
What is it with the Europeans? I was thinking about it, talking to a friend today, actually, and they're a bellicose group, aren't they? They're always at war with one another. I mean, I can't deny, you know, my own European heritage, I guess, in this respect, although being from, you know, being Celtic mainly in origin, I suppose, it's sort of that island, the United Kingdom or England, the island of the British Isles, I should say, always sit in some sort of obscurity to Europe in many respects. I guess ultimately they are part of it, though. But this, like, Ukraine is on fire, and there's you think about this, 300,000 Ukrainians have died since the outbreak of hostilities in February last year. Over 30,000 Russians too have been killed. That's extraordinary. And there's a lot of fighting still going on in and around the city of Bakhmut. I was looking at what I think is an impartial analyst. He's just talking about the military strategy itself. And there is a beachhead that the Ukrainians still have on the Russian side of the river that goes through Bakhmut, and he was talking about the problem that would incur for the Russian military, because if that beachhead remains there with the onset of spring, the grass will grow and it'll give cover for the reinforcements to come over the other side of the river to reinforce that position and cover for the tanks to hide in. And it's really, you know, impartial sort of analysis without the politics as much as that's possible. I'm not saying this person didn't have a dog in the fight. It sounded like he had a Russian accent to me, though it could have been Ukrainian. How would I really know from this distance? But he was really just talking about the battle itself. And, it's such a complex area to talk about, because I was talking to my friend today too, and he's telling me about the NATO troops in the US. So the US have a barracks in Germany, of course, which they have done since the cessation of hostilities in the Second World War. And they have a barracks which has 85,000 US troops stationed in it, very close, obviously, to being deployed in Ukraine. Some of them, I believe, have maybe already been deployed there. But what that's worth to that economy, to that German town where they are, where there's 85,000 US troops spending money and going out and being part of that society, it's worth so much money to people. NATO just spent $1 billion on a new office complex in Europe. $1 billion. So this idea that NATO would suddenly say, well, we've passed our use-by date, the Second World War ended 70 years ago, and this is, we can just walk away. Well, they're not going to walk away from that sort of infrastructure too. And who's going to rebuild Ukraine now too? Don't tell me there's not firms lining up, queuing up already to rebuild Ukraine. I'm sure there's firms lining up on both sides of the conflict, on the Russian side of the conflict and the, US alliance side of the conflict, that want to earn the contracts that will be part of that rebuilding. And NATO too have got, they've taken the Baltic states have become part of NATO, including Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania, which border with the Russian motherland, something that Russia said they would never let happen again at the cessation of hostilities of the Second World War. Yet here are the Baltic states, part of NATO. Putin actually tried to join NATO in the early 2000s, he was denied. He was denied. And, war is good for business. It makes people a lot of money. And then we all just become collateral damage as a result of that, and it's such a resources-rich country too, Russia, such a vast country too, so much of it actually in Asia, not European at all, but Asian. That was the basis on which they wouldn't let the Russians join NATO, because it wasn't Western enough in its influence and had too much of its landmass in Asia. The blowing up of the Nord Stream pipeline with the gas that was going to basically supply fuel to Western Europe but was denied, I would imagine, as Seymour Hersh had written, by the US alliance. So they blew it up instead. This, you know, you think about the so many killed in this conflict between the Ukrainians and the Russians. There's over 300,000 deaths, somewhere in the vicinity of 350,000 deaths in a year. And to put that in context, in the whole of the Vietnam War, there was 58,000 US soldiers killed. So I think a lot of this too is about containment maybe of Russia and potential of it to be a rising empire, and particularly as it now it's sort of allied itself in many respects with China, and the threat that poses to the world order. Not unlike the Germany that united under Otto von Bismarck in 1871. A group of states got together, German states got together. That's, I mean, Australia hadn't been federated yet, but we existed as a country. So you can see how late in the day that actually was that Germany united in 1871, and that proved too much of a threat to the status quo then. And look what happened. Look what happened as a result of that. There's something Paul Keating always used to talk about with the rise of China too, that if you constrict this state from rising, because it will rise anyway, then that may be more conflict involved in that. So that's what I guess is the importance ultimately of diplomacy and being diplomatic in a situation, especially if it's going to avoid such bloodshed that I have pointed out. If you've missed your favourite TNT radio show or interview, simply listen back when you want, wherever you want. Just visit episodes on the TNT Radio website. We are also on all the major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, Spotify, Amazon, Podbean, iHeart, and of course, TuneIn. Now there is no reason to miss out on anything on TNT Radio.
Getting straight to the facts.
Enough with the lies. We need facts.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
The Victorian Liberal MPs will be free to cast a conscience vote in the Voice to Parliament referendum, putting the state party at odds with its federal counterpart. That news is just too confusing to me. Jeremy, I'm glad you're going to sort it out for us. It's radio producer TNT from Taz Details to clarify this story. Jeremy?
Thanks, Damien. I was a bit confused when I first saw this news too. Now, we have opposition leader in the Victorian state government, John Pesciuto, confirmed this morning that the Liberal Party room had voted in favour of a non-binding position for MPs ahead of the Voice to Parliament referendum. He says, "This is a very important issue for our nation, and I certainly believe, as leader of the opposition here in Victoria, that it's important for members of the coalition to have a non-binding position, so they are free to approach that issue and determine it for themselves. There's a long way to go in this debate, and I'm sure all of us will continue to have important discussions with our friends and colleagues and neighbours across the community to talk about such an important issue." And he adds, "I think it's a common sense approach. It's a fair, it recognises that people have different viewpoints on this. And all I can say is that the parties we represent here today, we value the freedom of each member to determine for themselves which way they'll approach a national issue." Now, Damien, this position of the Liberal Party in the state of Victoria is at odds with the federal Liberal Party position, which will not allow its front benches to support the proposal, but backbenchers will, however, be allowed a free vote on the matter in the federal parliament. So that's the difference. State members of parliament are pretty much free to say what they want, pro or nay or yay. The federal Liberal Party has decided to have a formal party line, whereas the state of Victoria Liberal Party has decided to let each member make up their own minds.
Yeah, but Jeremy, it still doesn't make any sense, because why wouldn't they have a conscience vote on something that's in a different chamber? It's not even in their chamber. They've got their own voice. There's a Victorian voice that's happening in the Victorian chamber. What's the federal got to do with it? Like, they just increased the excise on tobacco. Do they want to know what the Liberal Victorian Liberals think in the Liberal State Parliament of a federal issue? What do they think about that, I wonder? What else do they – it seems to be a nonsense to me, Jeremy. How does it even
it is.
Make sense? Can you please?
It is all a nonsense, Damien. It's a complete nonsense. And of course, as we've said time and time again, we all have the voice through the parliament process as it is. Why do you want another voice that separates us on race? Really, the yes vote proposal is a racist proposal. It's just insane. And it does not make any sense at all. I think it would have been better if the Liberal Party in Victoria and other states took a strong position, a leadership position, and said, hang on, this is not something we can support. This divides Australia on lines of race. But there's no way that was going to happen because they've got so much division in the party, Damien.
It's just John Pesutto trying to appear far more moderate than Peter Dutton, ultimately, isn't he? Saying to, look at me, it's okay. I don't agree with what my feds are doing. I don't want to just take pot shots at them. So this is a way of me not taking pot shots at them, but still appearing to be, you know, the much gentler, small L liberal approach. So ultimately, I guess the Victorian Liberals going to their constituents may have some impact on talk to them. How much impact will they have on the public opinion as far as the voice is concerned?
I don't think the MPs will have much of an impact on public opinion. I think the marketing from the Yes campaign will be very strong. There's all the money, the corporate power behind all of that. Hopefully Australian people see through all that and vote no.
Jeremy Beck, news producer, thanks so much for that story. It's still no real clearer to me exactly what's going on here, but anyway, nonetheless, you are listening to TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Ask Vince Foster, who was found in a Washington, D.C. park with his feet elevated above his head and yet blood trickles going from his head toward his feet. It's like my cousin Vinny, right? Do the laws of physics cease to exist in your kitchen? How can you cook a grit faster than anyone else? Well, do the laws of physics cease to exist if the body is related to a Democrat? Dr. Gal Luft, who is the co-director of the Washington-based Institute for the Analysis of Global Security, was preparing to reveal explosive information about the Biden family international crime syndicate. Now, suddenly gone missing. Mysterious circumstances. After a court had released him on bail in Cyprus, Luft was an advisor to CEFC China Energy, the same company which paid Hunter Biden about $5 million in 2017 alone, the same $5 million that has been traced to 9 Biden crime family members.
Timothy Shea on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
Today's News Talk Radio.
Come on, let the man talk.
We never censor our hosts.
Good. Now, talk.
Uncensored news.
Today's News Talk Radio. TNT.
The man is talking, and he's going to introduce you to his next guest, which is the woman. Elizabeth Hart. She's an independent person. She's investigating the overuse of vaccine products and conflicts of interest in vaccination policy, the ethical aspects of over-vaccination, especially mandated vaccination, of particular interest to her. Elizabeth Hart, welcome back to the show. I talked to you many months ago.
Yes, Damon, lovely to be back. Thank you very much for having me.
Yes, you were the furious writer sending emails to different people, getting responses from them. Yeah, good. And
that's what I did.
Agitating. Right. Now, Elizabeth, we're going to talk about the fact that finally, and maybe what many would say belatedly, the US is going to end its vaccination requirements to enter the country on the 11th of May.
Yes. Yes, it's been a long time coming. It was mooted that that was going to happen. And then last week, the CDC came out and said they weren't going to do that. It was going to be a requirement for one dose around August. And this is very interesting, that that was announced on the 27th of April. And now that has been wiped aside. And the White House has announced, yes, it's going to go on the 11th of May. It's just very interesting to know what sort of machinations are going on over there.
Yeah.
That the CDC made that announcement. And, it's just interesting times, I think, what's going on.
Now, Elizabeth, can I ask you, because I'm just thrown by that. What's the thing with the one dose? We were always told that it was only two doses that would mean someone was vaccinated anyway. So what are they saying? You know, 2.5 years later, oh, no, you still need to have one dose. What machination could there possibly have been?
They were saying of the later type of vaccine, the bivalent or, you know, the later one, they were saying that that was if you had one dose of that one, okay. That was what they were saying. But it didn't make any sense because American citizens did not have to have the jabs to go from the country, and neither did immigrants. It was just visitors they were. It was totally ridiculous and illogical. And I think it was just purely vindictive to make – you know, to only accept people who had been compliant to the original doses. That's what it seems like to me, because there's just no science in that at all. It's just ludicrous that they got away with it so long and that this so-called science establishment hadn't retaliated against this. But at least now it is being dropped. But I think now is going to be the time for lots of review of what has been going on for the last 3 years and a lot of recriminations to be made, I think. And something that I'm going to really be focusing on is National Cabinet, as it was headed by Scott Morrison at the time, and the AHPPC, which was headed by the Chief Medical Officer, because a big moment in the COVID debacle was in June 2021, when the AHPPC had said they did not recommend compulsory COVID-19 vaccines for aged care workers. This is very significant. They had said mandating COVID-19 vaccination must balance the rights of an individual in the workplace against the public health benefits of vaccination at the time. That's what they said on the 4th of June, 2021. On the same day, it was announced by the ABC News, Scott Morrison to use National Cabinet to lobby state governments to go against the health advice on COVID vaccinations. And because they wanted to force aged care workers to get the coronavirus vaccine. And subsequently, the AHPPC folded and they went ahead and did that. Now, this is very important because once that principle of denying voluntary informed consent to one group was set in place, that set off the cascade of vaccination mandates. That's what set this disaster off in this country. And now we have to go back and see what happened in that National Cabinet and what they did.
And what do you think it was that happened? Do you think it was just they were frightened and it was just being, you know, overly precautious? Or do you think there was just too much money, follow the money, and they capitulated to Big Pharma?
Well, at the beginning, we know what Scott Morrison wanted at the beginning. He wanted it to be as mandatory as possible, didn't he? He denounced that in 2020. So that was the goal. That guy has flip-flopped. He's a duplicitous person, mandatory, not mandatory, all that sort of thing. So from the very beginning, this was always about the vaccine and making everybody have the vaccine. That's what it was from the beginning. That's what was laid out in the Neil Ferguson report that was published in March 2020, that there would be suppression of the virus until a vaccine becomes available. And it wasn't known at the time or wasn't disclosed at the time that Ferguson was sponsored by Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Now we know the significance of that. So this has always been about a vaccine market, getting people onto a digital ID. Now we need to look back at this and see what happened. There needs to be an urgent investigation. because Scott Morrison is the biggest traitor in Australia's history, along with the premiers. What they did to these people, demanding that everybody have these medical interventions and denying people voluntary informed consent, it's the most shocking thing to happen in a supposed free country.
Elizabeth, you talk about the National Cabinet, and that was brought about as a result of this response to this once in a generation or once in 100 years pandemic. But it has absolutely no jurisdiction. But everyone went along with it because of the, you know, the hysterical nature of the situation, of the response to COVID. But it still exists to this day because Albanese, it met the other day under Albanese, I think it was in Queensland. So yeah. The National Cabinet maintains its status, which was with no jurisdiction. Yeah, what is that about?
Yeah, how is this happening? Now they come out with, you know, is this the ID by stealth? Now they're coming out with a My Medicare ID or something. They're determined to get this thing happening. We've got to look at this. You know, we know what it felt like throughout this dreadful period where we were just disenfranchised. We were denied any input into any of this. We were just dictated to by this small group of people, these premiers. It's unbelievable to know, just look at what happened now, and we have to go back and check this out. How could Daniel Andrews demand that people be injected or you will be shut out of society? This is what he literally was saying.
You talk about the vaccinated economy. Yeah, the vaccinated economy.
What the hell is going on? That this is the most unbelievable thing that has happened, and people seem to be in some sort of stupor or amnesia that they don't realise the most significant political event in our history has occurred. And it's awful to think of what's happened and how many people were forced to have medical interventions. The medical profession is at the heart of this. They should never have gone along with mandates. This is what's got to be investigated too, that the medical officer, the chief medical officer was basically the chief honcho in this country during the emergency, supposedly. And this person is a doctor. How could he possibly have gone along with this idea of just trashing informed consent? He's got an obligation to get informed consent for a medical intervention. He's registered with APRA. I've got a letter from APRA confirming that, yes, they do have to get voluntary informed consent. And yet the chief medical officer went along with Scott Morrison's demand and trashed it for the aged care. And then subsequently there was a cascade of mandates. And it just, how many millions of people were jabbed in this country under mandates and denied voluntary informed consent?
Well, I think the Hippocratic Oath is something left over from a bygone era. Now we have, you know, socialised healthcare under Medicare, which, you know, everybody wants. It's a sacred cow. But it was weaponised against us. So there was no Hippocratic Oath between the patient, the confidentiality between the patient and the doctor, because it's the person paying the bills and the state is paying the bills. So the allegiance was between the doctor and the state ultimately, and that's what it's a part of the debate I don't think anybody would really be willing to have.
Well, we need to have that debate because I've written to Mark Dreyfus, the Attorney General, questioning whether the doctors were conscripted. And this can be going against the Australian Constitution, that they were conscripted. Not only the doctors, the army was conscripted. They were involved in this rollout. Everybody was conscripted, really. Businesses were conscripted. Everybody got involved with this idea of mandates, sports clubs, hospitality. All of a sudden it became, you could dictate people to have a medical intervention. Unbelievable. The legal profession went along with this. Nobody seemed to be alert or awake to the fact that you cannot do this. And now it's happened. We've got children, 2 million children, according to the government, have been injected against a disease that was of no threat to them. How has that happened? In the medical profession, its reputation is completely down the drain. And they have got to be brought to account for what they've done.
Well, this is what it is, though, isn't it? Because no one has been brought to account. As we say, the National Cabinet still rolls on and no one will be brought to account. The system itself needs to make sure that no one is brought to account so it continue to propagate and reward itself and those practitioners within the system.
It won't be brought to account if people don't demand it. We need to get people, we need this out in the court of public opinion. We need media that will report on this story, not conflicted media like the Murdoch media and what have you. They have to be brought to account. We can't take this negative attitude of, oh, it's too difficult. It's not too difficult. If you want freedom, you've got to fight for it and you've got to bring these people to account for what they've done. It's absolutely outrageous. And another person has to be brought to account is Anthony Fauci. I've just written a letter to him and his co-authors on an article that came out earlier this year, where they have admitted that flu jabs and COVID jabs are rubbish. To put it in layman's terms, they're rubbish. And I've written to them now calling this out, that they've been exploiting people for years with these useless injections and lately mandating them. And they admit that they don't know this at all. It's just, it's absolutely incredible. And the fact that the science and medical establishment isn't capable of calling this out itself, because people have been so suppressed and they're just not capable of calling out wrongdoing now, because they're under threat, say doctors, for example, are under threat of getting struck off. You've just got this whole medical science establishment is so dangerous for the public now, coming to a head now with COVID, with all these people injected with these COVID jabs, which they shouldn't have had to have.
I'm talking to Dr. Melissa McCann, who's representing people and taking a class action on behalf of the vaccine injured. So maybe there is people beginning to push back. But the difficulty too, isn't it, that you will be pilloried as an anti-vaxxer. I talked to Dr. Chris Neal from AMPS yesterday, and the problem is that all of us that would make this argument is seen as an anti-vaxxer, and the media reports on you as being an anti-vaxxer. I don't know if you've looked at your Wikipedia page lately, if you've got one, but I'm sure it says somewhere pretty in the first line or two that, you know, you're an anti-vaxxer as well, Elizabeth Hart.
I don't think I'll have a Wikipedia page. I'm a bit sort of under the radar, I think. I'm just a person demanding accountability. And I'm not buying into this anti-vaxxer rubbish. We've got to get on the front foot with this. These are the people who've committed wrongdoing. Let's not take this sort of like, oh, you know, worried about what they're name-calling. This is a medical intervention. Don't buy into this anti-vaxxer rubbish. They have pushed medical interventions on people. They have compelled people to have medical interventions. They're the people who need to get worried. And we need to start making them worried about this.
Well, we'll go to the news break and we'll come straight back and see how much we can actually make them worried right now on the radio. You are listening to TNT Radio.
What station is this?
Station. Ladies and gentlemen,
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylan here with a look at your TNT headlines. The streets of Paris have again been filled with smoke and tear gas as annual May Day demonstrations coincide with anti-government protests. The US military says it's tracking another mystery balloon which has been detected flying over the Hawaii Islands, and Russia's ramped up its exports of fertilizer to emerging markets in Asia and Africa in the face of Western sanctions.
Damian Richardson on today's News Talk. TNT Radio.
We're talking to Elizabeth Hart, who's just a person fighting back on behalf of the people against the vaccine mandates. Elizabeth, you're saying that you wrote to an email, yeah, to Dr. Anthony Fauci in the US. Can you tell us the contents of that email and what hope you have as a result that you might even hear back from him?
Well, I wrote to him and his fellow authors on this article. As I said, it was published in January this year. And just to quote them, you know, in their article, they say, as of 2022, after more than 60 years of experience with influenza vaccines, very little improvement in vaccine prevention of infection has been noted. As pointed out decades ago, and still true today, the rates of effectiveness of our best approved influenza vaccines would be inadequate for licensure for most other vaccine-preventable diseases. And I respond to that, really? So what is this? Just out and out fraud, you know. And then they admit the SARS-CoV-2 vaccines. They say they admit they elicit an incomplete and short-lived protection against evolving virus variants that escape population immunity. The rapid development, and then they say that they're no use. And then they say the rapid development and deployment of SARS-CoV-2 vaccines has saved innumerable lives and help to achieve early partial pandemic control. They get away with this rubbish, complete contradictory rubbish in an article, because people within that sphere are incapable of calling out the great Anthony Fauci. I mean, I don't know what sort of peer review these articles go through. I mean, I've only just started with this article. It is full of solid gold, this article, and I'm going to take it apart and I'm just going to write them various emails on different parts of the article. It is unbelievable. And I just called it out. I just said to them in the email, how have you gotten away with this utter bullshit for so long? It is unbelievable, because the science and medical establishment is just captured by the church of vaccination, and they're incapable of calling this out, because they know if they do, they'll be scrubbed, they'll lose their research funding, or they'll be struck off if they're a doctor. So we've got to do this work ourselves. They have exploited us for years. Billions of dollars has been squandered on this. Look at this COVID. This COVID industry was created out of thin air. Think of the amount of money in the last 3 years that has been squandered on COVID. The testing, all that testing should not be happening. Who's making all the money out of the testing? The assault with the testing, that, you know, thing being shoved up people's noses. It's outrageous. How many tests are they collecting DNA samples or whatever? And the amount of money spent on the vaccine products. It's beyond belief that the misery they've caused. We've got so-called health officers who've demanded that people stay in their homes and be depressed and break up family relationships and not go out in the sunshine. Could you imagine the very antithesis of what a health officer should be saying? This is the most incredible thing we have been through. And now is the time for people to wake up and demand retribution.
It's like the state now is trying to back away from this process, though, isn't it? Because as part of their letting people into the US that without any vaccine requirement on the 11th of this month, they're also going to pull back on people in the health services needing to be vaccinated or have vaccine requirements, educators and people working in government healthcare facilities. And that's the epicenter of where they suggested, wow, those people need it more than anybody. So they're actually collapsing the whole narrative and they're going to back away from it altogether if they can. Is that right?
Well, there are mandates still in place here. I've been writing to the health minister in South Australia saying, what's going on? You're mandating COVID jabs here. No response. You know, because these people aren't accountable. We are stuck with illegitimate governments. This is what's happening. These governments aren't legitimate. We've got to just demand a complete look at this whole political system. What happened in Australia in 2020? A coup took place because all of a sudden we were just taken over and ordered about. Stay in your homes. Wear a mask. Because everybody was, you know, blindsided at the time because they thought there was this killer virus around. When they knew damn well from the beginning that this so-called illness wasn't a problem for most people, they knew that from the very beginning, and yet they captured everybody in this net, including children, and injected them. The biggest crime of all time.
Yes, and that's what Professor Naomi Wolf's been saying in the US. I saw her give a dissertation at a college there this week or last week now. She was saying this is the greatest crime ever committed against humanity. There's been some extraordinary crimes committed against humanity. And she says also that the pharmaceutical companies, particularly according to the Pfizer's, their own documents, knew within 2 months that the vaccine had no efficacy. One of the side effects of the vaccine was actually to induce COVID.
Yeah. And they knew that from the beginning too. You know, that all of these cases, these should have been reported as an adverse event after the injection. How many cases of COVID after the vaccinations were reported to the TGA? They would just then say, oh, because it's happening so often, it's expected, it's mild or whatever. All of those cases should have been reported because this shows that this product was completely and utterly useless and it should not have been given to, possibly worse than useless, could be causing harm. But it was certain people's immune systems could have dealt with this thing. They didn't need to be injected with this stuff, this fast-tracked, goodness knows what is in it, injection. It's beyond belief, and it's. I'm just being bewildered the whole time because I can't believe it. I can't believe the medical profession went along with this. And I've already mentioned it to you before. I've written so many letters to them, pleading with them, saying, you have to get informed consent. And they just would ignore me. And but APRA, the evil APRA, at least I got a letter out of them confirming, yes, the health practitioners do have to get, you know, informed consent, but they weren't doing it. The only person that some doctors have been calling this out, and most obviously William Bay strode into an AMA conference and called out Paul Kelly in front of everybody and called him a liar. This is what we needed. We needed a whole gang of William Bays out there, but here he was on his own, you know. Where were the rest of them? He put himself out there and called them out. And to see the vision of that, to see those people that were in that conference wearing their, you know, masks, scurrying away as William Bay went in there, these little rats moving out of the way, it was pathetic. And there's William Bay has taken them on and he's bringing APRA to court. That's what we need. Get more people like him. Where are they?
APRA saying that doctors needed informed consent would feel very much to the practitioner, the, you know, the GP on the ground, like they're being thrown under the bus by the authority, wouldn't it?
Well, well, it's a very peculiar situation, isn't it? There's ARTPA telling them they're supposed to be getting informed consent. And at the same time, in the position statement that was put out in March 21, putting them in the picture as that you've got to toe the line with this. We were relying on you to get people submitting to the jabs. You need to get the jabs yourself and don't question anything. Pretty tricky situation. But at the time, it just indicates how the profession as a whole was not equipped to be able to speak out against that, to be able to challenge that. They should have been able to challenge that. And yet people were just too afraid to speak out. And that's why very few people were afraid to speak out. And there were doctors who were getting suspended for giving exemptions. Big question has to be asked is, what is an exemption? Why do people need to get an exemption? They're supposed to be giving a voluntary informed consent to this. How can you have to get an exemption to not have a medical intervention? This exemption idea has been allowed to settle in. Why weren't health practitioners questioning the exemption idea? Because it shouldn't exist. There shouldn't be exemptions. The whole thing is a mess.
You have a website, and you so rightly point out, and your website, I just let the listeners know because they might be interested in looking it up. It's vaccinationispolitical.net. So vaccinationispolitical.net to look up Elizabeth Hart's website. But you're right, it is political. And I'll finish on this question if you just give me a quick answer. And we know that too, don't we? Even with the US deciding now on May the 11th, people can arrive in the country without requiring to reveal their vaccination status. But there's been, in that period of 2.5 years, there's been millions of illegal arrivals coming over the Rio Grande, and there's been no requirement on them whether they were vaccinated or not. Because if this really did worry authorities and people were going to die as a result, if it wouldn't matter how people came in, they would really want to know what their vaccination status was.
That's right. It's just ridiculous, isn't it? It's just ridiculous. And what's ridiculous is that hasn't been called out before this. And who would you expect to be able to call that out? The medical profession themselves. They just didn't do it. They just went along with it. How many health practitioners actually bullied people into getting the injections? And we'll see now with, I'm bringing up Rogers versus Whitaker. We've got people who were not experts in COVID or COVID vaccinations. They were giving these injections. They weren't qualified to do this. They didn't have the expertise. And we had people being ordered to show up in front of them by the likes of Daniel Andrews and Mark McGowan. It's just when I'm saying it, I can't believe that this has happened. When
you think of Daniel Andrews,
vaccinated economy, and say you're out of society, there is an apartheid created here. People were excluded from society. That is a stain that's going to be on for Australia forevermore.
Even as he's promoting diversity and inclusion. Yes, Elizabeth Hart, thank you so much for joining me on the Damien Richardson Show.
Thanks, Damien.
You're listening to TNT Radio.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been red-pilled on the climate agenda. You won't believe what he has to say.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
RFK Jr. has seen the light about the United Nations and World Economic Forum climate agenda. Here is RFK Jr. announcing his presidential campaign on the Kim Iverson Show.
Climate issues and pollution issues are being exploited by, the World Economic Forum and Bill Gates and all of these big, mega billionaires. The same way that COVID was exploited, but to use it as an excuse to clamp down top-down totalitarian controls on society.
Kennedy went on to say the most important solution for environmental issues is not top-down controls, it's free market capitalism. All I can say is, wow, a Democrat presidential candidate talking sense on climate, COVID, and tyranny. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
Issues that impact you are the same issues that impact Damien Richardson on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
I first became aware of my next guest earlier in the year. She was part of a vaccine conference that was hosted by Dr. Peter McCullough. And this is Dr. Melissa McCann. She's a GP from Queensland. And since first she was accepting of the COVID narrative, she became very suspicious of it. And now she's gotten to the point where she was speaking out against that narrative at this particular conference, and now has also become part of a class action on behalf of vaccine injured Australians. Dr. McCann, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Damien. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much for coming back. Now, I know last time I talked to you was a couple of months ago, and the idea was then you weren't really at liberty to discuss the class action at that particular point in time. But could you tell us now, fill us in on where it's at and what's going on?
Yeah, well, now that the action's been filed, there is a little bit more that I can say about the class action. So this was filed last week in the federal court, the Sydney Registry. I guess from here there'll be a few weeks for the next, you know, meetings and mediations and all that sort of thing, but the case is now sort of live and on foot. So it is, there's been a bit of interest in it, which is really, I think, been a really positive thing, particularly some of these injured people that just really haven't been able to talk freely about what's happened to them. And so I think it's really positive that there's been a bit more attention and a bit more being spoken about these things.
So you say it's been filed in court. Can you just describe to us, explain to us, what does that even mean? And what do you hope to get as a result of the outcome if you're successful?
This is what's called a civil matter. So what it's asking for is a very different to some of the other actions that have been brought before the courts in Australia in relation to, you know, COVID-related matters. So this is the first one that has for an action that is specifically seeking relief or compensation for on behalf of injured parties. And this one's being brought as a class action. And so there are three injured people who are named, and they're bringing this action on behalf of themselves, but on behalf of the entire class, which is everyone in Australia who's had a serious injury. And so when the matter is filed in this type of matter, we're able to submit a lot of the scientific evidence and the facts. It's called the pleadings. And that's been something that has been worked on for many months now, and it's actually a really comprehensive pleading, comprehensive filing, hundreds of pages actually. So I guess one of the things we hope to achieve is, if even just having that evidence before a court, is I think going to bring some really much needed attention and discussion around these issues. But then hopefully the outcome will be, if the action succeeds, that everyone with an injury has a really easy path to having compensation for their injury.
Okay, so there's been a lot of vilification in the media of anyone who stood up. Do you think this process might be part of some of that softening? There has been certain softening in certain sections of the mainstream media as far as people having been vaccine injured. Do you think that will further this process?
I hope so. I hope that just by bringing something in a very, not to suggest that other actions haven't been equally, you know, brought properly, but that just being able to bring this action in a really, you know, correct and legitimate way and on behalf of people who have medically confirmed serious injuries, that it will just, I guess, open up a bit more of that discussion around these injuries, and so that people can start speaking a bit more freely about it. That's definitely something that I am seeing a little bit, and I'm hoping for as action moves along.
So there's three people being represented. If these people are successful, then the other people will be able to use that as a template. There'll be some sort of precedent. Is that what I'm led to believe?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, so obviously I'm not the lawyer.
No.
But yeah, my understanding of it is that there's almost two parts to a class action. So the first part is where the judge reviews all of the evidence that's being brought to them, and so that includes a lot of the scientific evidence or pleadings, as I mentioned, that outlining some of the alleged concerns with the way that these products were licensed, and then the way that the safety monitoring was undertaken. And importantly, whilst the injuries have been medically confirmed, of course, all of those claims about that decision making, that's what's being alleged, so that has to be determined by the court. And then if it is determined that those actions have led to basically a claim for negligence, then it means that anyone with an injury it is able to then claim for their losses. And it's, I guess my understanding is even that second part, the claiming losses, is a sort of more streamlined process because the courts have very clear ways of working out how to calculate losses for personal injuries and compensation.
So these three people feeling an inordinate amount of pressure that their case will determine what happens with, you know, potentially thousands of other people as well?
No, they haven't. They haven't discussed any particular pressure in terms of representing. There was actually a larger group with, again, very, very clear, very solid medical evidence to had also volunteered to be part of that lead group, and in the end, these three were decided by the legal team. But they know that they've got a very large group of injured parties behind them who are grateful and supportive of what they're doing. And certainly, they all struggle with their injuries every day, and it's important that they're not under any undue pressure. But in terms of bringing the action, there's a lot of people who are really wanting to participate in this and wanting to bring it on behalf of others and to try to help others who've had an injury.
Liz, can you tell me the nature of the injuries these three people have got?
Yes, so one man named Gareth, he has severe myopericarditis and consequence of that had to have open heart surgery. A man in his 40s where this had a really serious impact on his work, his ability to care for his family and his enjoyment of his life, and some long-lasting impacts of that. Another is a man named Tony, who's experienced a sort of neurological adverse event and a severe sort of chronic fatigue syndrome. Again, a young man who's been completely incapacitated by this. And some of these are the symptoms that aren't readily diagnosable. There's no test for it. It's been confirmed by medical specialists that it's causal from the vaccine. And of course, those are the questions that the court will also have to review. But it's difficult for many people who've suffered with these neurological events in that there's no real name for it. There's no, we're in uncharted waters. We really don't even understand medically why these events are happening. And then the third is the man who had inflammation of the brain and spinal cord, Antonio, who had encephalitis after the vaccine. He was completely disabled for some months, wheelchair bound and unable to care for himself, and remains unable to walk unaided.
So were these all your patients, Melissa, or not?
No. My interest in the action started from, or my interest in, I guess, considering taking an action like this came from direct observations that where I'd seen adverse events with my patients, but none of these three are my patients, and there's been hundreds actually, Damien, who've contacted me over the past sort of 6 to 9 months, who have just been through word of mouth. They've just reached out and they've just wanted to participate or expressed interest in being part of the action, and they've sent through their medical records and told me what's happened to them.
So, Melissa, what will be your expertise will be relied on in the courtroom, I imagine, to will be an onus on proof to prove that these injuries these people have sustained indeed were from the vaccines?
Well, I'm not. I guess I've played a role in bringing the action to this point, and I'm sure I'll continue supporting, and I'm involved in the crowdfunding and that sort of thing. But I'm not an expert. I'm a GP, so I can only speak to what I've seen, and that's what prompted me to instigate the action. But there's quite a number of actual experts who are really keen to participate in this action and to provide expert evidence to the court if and when that's needed. So it would be experts who would provide that type of evidence that you've mentioned about causality.
Okay. And so is it a panel of judges or just one judge? What's the process there?
That's not something I've asked specifically the legal team, but I can see on the federal court website, and that's something that, yeah, anyone can look up sort of class action rules. So I understand that it gets allocated to a judge, and then sometimes there's a second judge that's allocated to help with case management, but there's generally one judge who is, as best as I understand it.
So this is just initial stages, isn't it? The judge will have to even decide whether it actually goes to trial or not. Is that right? Or are you already at the point where it will definitely go to trial?
My understanding is with class actions especially, I think we have some really unique rules, it seems, in Australia where there's a lot of protections and processes around class actions and a requirement that once filed, everything that happens is in the best interest of the class, because it's not just about the three people who are named, but that whatever happens from here has to be in the best interest of the entire class. So my understanding is that there's first a range of mediation meetings and that there's a judge that oversees that, and that perhaps efforts are made in that to look at settlement, if that's in the best interest of the class and that sort of thing. So, it's certainly a class action that's commenced, but then whether that goes to trial or not, my understanding is that that's something that the judge has a lot of discussions about as to what's the best interest of the class.
So if the action is successful, ultimately it will mean that the Australian taxpayer foots the bill for these injuries. So the losses are socialised through the taxation system. Is there any possibility that there would be a class action actually taken out against Big Pharma, as we've seen quite recently? Professor Naomi Wolf was pointing it out. I was talking to her about her with my last guest as well, that the Pfizer documents show that Pfizer knew that there was no efficacy of these vaccines within months of the rollout, but choose to stay mum and say nothing about it. It took 4 months for the US government to even reveal that to the population. So is there a possibility that there could be a class action taken out on behalf of people against the pharmaceutical industry itself?
Yeah, well, certainly I would think that's a possibility. I mean, that's not something that's not what this class action is being brought against. This is being brought against the government, the regulator, the TGA, and the decision makers in regards to the decision to approve and then continue to approve in the safety monitoring. But certainly there's no legal restriction in Australia that would stop another group or other groups of people bringing actions directly against the company. As I understand it, as I believe it was publicly announced, was that when these contracts were being signed for purchasing of the vaccines, that there was in general a requirement that the country or the government would indemnify the companies in any case, so that I suppose regardless that the government would end up being responsible for indemnifying for any injuries. But of course, as I understand it, I don't think that's been made public, but I know there were announcements to that effect. There would be nothing stopping someone from taking any other sort of action in regards to their injury.
I'm sure that indemnity, the legality of that indemnity itself is arguable in a court of law.
Yeah, I mean, look, I wouldn't know, but I think, I guess in the first instance, this is perhaps opening up the conversation that more of these injuries are happening, and then I suppose where, if any, there might have been some negligence. And I guess in regards to that point that you raised previously about the companies being aware of there being perhaps limited data around, say, the prevention of transmission. And I guess you're referring to that statement from the European Union where that was sort of publicly announced. But it is the case, and this is publicly available information as well, that information was available to the TGA, in fact, and that forms part of the publicly available OSPAR documents, that none of the vaccines actually met what's called the secondary efficacy endpoint of demonstrating any reduction of transmission. So I guess that's where this case will be presenting that evidence to a judge, just in regards to what was known and what wasn't known, and then the decisions that were made on the basis of that.
So what are the scope of the outcome of this process, this class action? Is it just to find, well, there is a legal basis for these people to be compensated, or is there consequences at stake for the administrators of state that, enforced this program in the first place?
Look, that I'm not sure of. I mean, what the case as filed is arguing is a case for negligence, misfeasance, and breach of statutory duty by several of the named respondents, which includes the health minister, former health minister, and a former deputy secretary for the TGA and others, I don't believe that there's any consequences otherwise, other than being named in that action and whether they may have to speak to that or provide evidence. I couldn't say if there's any other consequences. All I know is that's what's filed and that's what's arguing. But are you meaning like that some other action might be taken against them personally or something like that?
So just ultimately be public opprobrium and they'll be able to say, well, we were just following orders.
It would be interesting to see what defence, what defence is raised, what defence is mounted, I guess, against all of the allegations that have been made as part of the action.
Well, Dr. Melissa McCann, thanks so much for coming back onto the show and giving us the update on this class action. Obviously, we would love to keep following up with you as the proceedings to continue.
Thank you. Thanks very much for having me on, and thanks for taking interest in
format. Yeah, thanks for your efforts, Doctor. I was interested too that the lipid nanoparticles from these vaccines do secrete themselves, even though the pharmaceutical companies said they don't secrete in the body anywhere. They're dispersed. Well, they're not dispersed. They secrete within the human organs. Thank you so much for listening to the Damien Richardson Show. You're listening, of course, to TNT Radio.